I come from the field of Helicobacter. So I was already worked, that's a mucosal pathogen actually that mostly lives in the stomach. So I was working on bacteria that can adhere to mucosal layers and communicate with the host. So when I first saw Akkermansia on an EM picture, electron microscope picture, I saw these long flagelli, pili things sticking out. And thinking about molecular communication with the host, I was thinking, if there's something that the host is responding towards, it's these pili.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series on metabolic health through the gut. In this series, we speak with experts about how gastrointestinal physiology, including gut microbes, can affect cardiometabolic health and body weight. This week, we're highlighting an episode from our archives.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And our guest today is Cara Belzer. And Cara is Associate Professor of Microbiology in the Laboratory of Microbiology in Wageningen University. Her group is called, has a very interesting title, Microbes, Mucus, and Milk. So, Cara, you're very, very welcome. How did you come to pick this as the topic you wanted to devote your research to?
Yes, well, thank you for the invitation. Yes, well, of course, the three M's, that sounds nice, but that didn't come out of nothing. So why is my group focusing on microbes, mucus, and milk? It's because both in mucus and milk are super interesting glycans, as we call them. So they're change of sugars, which only microbes can use that have specialized in living in host environments. So microbes could also be the word microbiome. I focus on microbes that live inside the host and in that host focus on surviving on sugars that are produced by the host. And in this case, these are mainly human milk oligosaccharides or mucus glycans.
And I often hear that said in seminars and things that, you know, the baby cannot digest the sugars, the HMOs that a mother produces in milk, and we can't, you know, consume our own mucus. Is that completely true? Are we just absolutely unable to digest these sugars, or is it just we're not very good at digesting them?
We're definitely not very good in digesting them. And when they're fragmented into smaller fragments, yes, we can use them. And what should not be misunderstood is that in milk, there's also a lot of lactose, which is a disaccharide, and that is used by the infant. It's actually the main sugar used by the infant. But the longer sugar chains, they are complex, so they cannot be absorbed also because they're so long. But as soon as they're cleaved or digested a little bit, then the host can also use it. But the idea is that they end up in the large intestine, so that they are not absorbed in the small intestine. And then there is where microbes actually start to nibble on them.
And of course, it must take a lot of energy from the mother, from the mother's metabolism, to produce these long, complicated sugars. And she's not doing it without reason. And so, again, what we hear is it's an evolutionary adaptation to promote the growth of the right microbes in the baby's gut. And you can elaborate on that maybe a little bit for us, what the right microbes are. But I assume as well that some pretty bad microbes have probably seen this sugar source and have adapted to grow on it as well. Is that true? Or is it uniquely good bacteria that grow on these HMOs?
Well, to answer that question, I think you have to first look at mother's milk as a whole. So there's not only these HMOs in there. There's a lot of immune molecules in there that suppress the pathogens already. So even if there are pathogens or bacteria that can cause infection, that can also use these sugars, they are suppressed already by other components that in mother's milk. Another interesting thing that in mother's milk, there's a lot of secretions that are coming from cells. So also secretions like urea, for example, that you wouldn't expect in mother's milk. So some things we are really not sure if it's purpose or non-purpose. Fact is that the HMO content is really high, and that indeed it seems that only the bacteria seem to benefit from these HMOs. So yeah, it seems to be an evolutionary adaptation from the mother and the bacteria to sustain this symbiotic relationship between beneficial bacteria that are not suppressed by the immune molecules from the human milk, not suppressed by the acidic environment that is created in the infant gut, and at the same time can use this HMO as a source of carbon.
And it seems then that sometimes this discussion kind of strays almost into, you know, obviously infant formula doesn't contain exactly the same sugars or perhaps not many of the same types of sugars at all. What would you say to mothers who are worried that, you know, what if I don't breastfeed, then my baby's going to get a really bad start in life? Do you think that's the case or how would you react to that?
That's a difficult question, of course, because I think always the best food for your infant is human breast milk. Of course, if there's any reason that you cannot provide this breast milk, then you could go for infant formula. And infant formula is just very different. What we do see is that the innovations on infant formula, and I think that's one of the most interesting things for the human microbiome field, is that they focus on the human microbiome already before that we called it maybe human microbiome. The infant formula was designed to stimulate bacteria in the infant gut and to have a certain acidity in the infant gut that is created by the bacteria. So it's two-sided. One is breast milk is just much more complex. There's so much more in there than just HMOs or just immune molecules or all this, even nitrogen, all these kinds of things. On the other hand, if you use infant formula, then that is that is just what you need to do. And hopefully there will be a lot of innovations so that that is the best support that is most similar to breast milk. Having said this, maybe because the main group of bacteria that is stimulated by human milk oligosaccharides is the group of bifidobacteria. And these are also stimulated by glycans that are added to infant formula. These glycans are different from human milk oligosaccharides, but they also stimulate the growth of bifidobacteria, which are different bifidobacteria, but they have the same function in sense of creating an acidic environment, stimulating the immune system, for example, and creating this whole microbiome network of bacteria.
You have done so much important work on Akkermansia. Can you talk to us about its role in the health of the human starting from infancy and going up to adulthood?
Yes, that's a nice question because we began our podcast with saying, well, I work on microbes, mucus, and milk. And we have several hypotheses that we work on. And one is that the human milk glycan environment in the infant gut also stimulates bacteria that can grow in the mucosal layer. And that those bacteria that can grow on mucus, they use very similar enzymes to degrade the mucosal layer so they can survive on HMOs. And those are the first ones to actually enter the mucosal layer so that you have this succession there with healthy microbes. And what some people might not know that there is actually microbes growing in the mucosal environment, which is like a mucal biome, we call it. If you have microbes growing in your mucosal layer, and these are the ones that can also support health, the human milk might actually help to get those in that mucosal layer very early on. And then, yes, and then there's Akkermansia muciniphila that I've been working on for the past decades. And this is really a mucosal colonizing bacteria. You find it mostly in adults, but you also already find it in infants. And in one of the first studies that we did, we wanted to prove that this mucosal degradation, the enzymes that are used to degrade mucosal glycans, would also support growth on human milk oligosaccharides. So we grew Akkermansia muciniphila on HMOs, and we saw that yes, indeed, even though it's not its preferred glycans, it does support growth and survival of Akkermansia, which proves or would at least give more evidence to our hypothesis that when entering the infant gut, it can survive in this HMO environment and then find its niche in this mucosal environment of the infant gut and start to grow there and build a microbial network in this mucosal environment. And then, yes, when Akkermansia is inside this mucosal layer, it's actually very dominant. And our research has shown that it can have many benefits to host response when Akkermansia is actually growing in your mucosal layer.
And I know, Clara, that mother's milk, the HMOs, are somewhat at least influenced by the mother's genetics. So mothers don't all produce the exact same array of HMOs. They're different. Is the same true of mucus? Is that also genetically based?
And actually, it's the exact same gene. So if you're, I think you're referring to the FUD gene. So that if you're able to express or not express the fructose sugar at the end of the glycans,
yes.
If you don't express it in the milk, you also don't express it in your mucosal layer. So this is the same. The funny thing is there's quite some research done on this, but if the mother is FUD negative, so not expressing these sugars, it doesn't have to mean that the child is also FUD negative, right? So then the human milk can be depleted of fructose, but the mucosal layer can still have fructose. But it is true that you see also difference in the microbiome when there is a different genetic background with different sugar content in these glycans that are expressed by the human host. Yeah, that's a good point.
How important do you think mucus is as a food source in the colon, for example? Do you think it's the primary source of carbohydrate, or is it simply, you know, a minority source, or only for the ones actually living in the mucus layer?
Yes. So the glycans that come from food, those are determining your luminal microbiome, right? Because that is the main carbohydrates that are present. And the more diverse the fibers, so the dietary glycans that you consume, the more diverse the microbes will be in your luminal content. And that's also why, especially this Akkermansia is so special. It is really adapted to this mucosal layer. So it really is not so competitive when you try to grow it on dietary glycans, it will not grow. But as soon as you add a little bit of mucus, it has this niche where it survives. So it's a segregation of bacteria that have different roles and different niches in this gut environment.
And there is that crosstalk too that the Akkermansia has, and that has implications for obesity. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Because I know that's an issue that many of us struggle with.
Yes. So when we first discovered Akkermansia, we just went back. So the state was that it wasn't seen yet because the way to detect this organism wasn't perfect. So the 16S primers didn't detect this organism. So we went back. Primers were redesigned, and we went to a lot of databases. And the first thing that caught our eye was actually that lean individuals have higher relative abundances of this Akkermansia in their gut than individuals that are overweight. And that led to the first experiments in collaboration with Patrice Camille, where he did an experiment with mice on a high-fat diet. And we cultured Akkermansia, and they got a daily gavage with Akkermansia as a probiotic. And then we saw that these mice gained a lot less weight when they had Akkermansia living in their intestines. And in the past years, we did more and more research on this, where we see that Akkermansia can thicken the mucosal layer, which improves the insulin sensitivity. And also it stimulates several immune factors like TLR2. So it seems that when it's colonizing this mucosal layer, it's changing the mucosal layer to be thicker, but it also modulates the metabolic response and the immune response of the host. And this all together might contribute to a lean phenotype.
So that's a very complicated picture. And I know you don't have time now to educate us on all the details of that. But it's not that the Akkermansia is, I don't know, somehow restricting calories from being taken up or reducing appetite, or maybe it does contribute to a reduction in appetite. But it's more about educating the immune system and barrier function and things like that. Is that the hypothesis?
Yes, I think the main thing is barrier function, actually, because when your barrier is damaged, then the immune system is over-responding, and also the metabolic responses are a lot worse. And when you can recover this gut barrier or thickening the gut barrier, then there's more dampening of all these signals that come from the lumen. And that might already help, for example, to reduce some of those over responses that take place when the barrier is thinner. We also saw examples, for example, in fast aging mice. We know that with becoming older, the mucosal layer is also getting thinner, and that there's a lot of inflammation going on in humans, for example, when they get older. And we also saw a correlation with the presence of Akkermansia and the immune aging. And here we also saw that the presence of Akkermansia increases this gut barrier. So it could be that when you have Akkermansia there, then maybe, yeah, you are more protected against this decreased gut barrier.
And can I ask you a very kind of, maybe it's a very stupid question, but do you think Akkermansia, I mean, you would imagine through evolutionary history, human evolutionary history, that whenever we had access to calories and fat, we would have wanted to put on as much weight as quickly as possible to help us survive through the winter where food was not plentiful. And now, of course, some of us are lucky enough to live in societies where food is very plentiful, and putting on weight is seen as a negative phenotype. Has acromantia kind of morphed from being a bad bug for people to have because it would have prevented them putting on weight to becoming a good bug because of societal change and things like that? Or do you think?
Yeah, I do support this hypothesis, actually. I think being a lean phenotype, now it's more an appearance, right? And it seems to be healthy, but I think it can be an unhealthy phenotype when you cannot put on enough weight to, exactly like you say, when to get through the winter, for example. The funny thing is that when you look at animal, at industrial animal breeding, the opposite is true. They want animals to gain weight as fast as possible. And they look at the microbiome from a very different angle, the opposite angle that we look at it for humans. So both these hypotheses are very valid and very true. The thing is, do we correlate it to health or not to health? Of course, yeah, there's a healthy weight and there's an overweight that is also associated with disease. So being morbid obese is not a healthy phenotype, of course.
Lara, you've also done a lot of important work on integrating information from different levels like omics and culture-based approaches. I wonder if you have any thoughts about the balance that up-and-coming scientists are having in maybe neglecting the culture-based approaches and maybe eating on a diet of too much omics, or do you think it's fine how things are? Do you have advice for up-and-coming scientists about how they should balance out their own training?
Yes, so only doing culture omics, I think, or only doing omics, I think, is not enough. I think it's been very helpful for making associations. Me, myself, I'm trained as a molecular geneticist. So I've been from the start combining it, for example, with proteomics to be able to connect it to function. And we find very interesting findings combining the taxonomics association with the functional profiles to see what glycans are they possibly consuming by expressing actually the proteins, the enzymes that could degrade those enzymes. And that gave really nice results. What we're doing now, and that's, I think, the I think very, very important for the upcoming scientists, is a lot of culturomics. So making synthetic microbial communities in robot gut systems. And these are interesting for several reasons. We are all familiar with fecal microbiota transplantations, but of course the feces are, well, undefined and they can be dangerous. So there are a lot of scientists and companies trying to find a way around it to not have to use feces. And one of the ways around it might be to have 10, 15, 20 microbes that are healthy or not pathogenic, that form a microbial network together that can do the whole digestion of your food, immune stimulation, all the trophic environments, and then maybe put that in an individual that would otherwise need a fecal microbial transplantation. So we're making a lot of microbial synthetic communities. We have one that resembles a healthy host, a human adult, one that resembles an infant, and one that resembles a mucosal microbiome. And what we're doing is to grow them then in the lab in anaerobic bioreactors. We stimulate them with different glycans to see what microbes is doing what. But what we also do, for example, is that we have a community without Acromantia, and then we add Acromantia later on to see what if you would consume Acromantia probiotic, would it still find a niche? Would it still be able to grow when there's already microbes that have a stable community? So I think for the future of research, yes, we should know what is there, but we should use this information to really find out more about the function, the microbial ecology that's going on in the gut.
And Clary, I mean, Acromantia is also a kind of a poster boy for postbiotics, if I can use that pun. And so these are dead bacteria, which still seem to maintain their health benefit. Was that a surprise to you that, you know, how did you react to that, seeing that the dead Acromantia was able to perform the same kind of health functions as the live Acromantia?
Yeah, I was not surprised because it was my own idea. So I come from the field of Helicobacter. So I was already worked, that's a mucosal pathogen actually that mostly lives in the stomach. So I was working on bacteria that can adhere to mucosal layers and communicate with the host. So when I first saw Akkermansia on an EM picture, electron microscope picture, I saw these long flagelli, pili things sticking out. And thinking about molecular communication with the host, I was thinking, if there's something that the host is responding towards, it's these pili. So the first endeavor was to figure out what protein is in those pili. It took a while, but then... Then we figured out this, we called it AMOC-1100, that's just the gene number of the protein. And then we thought, well, we can purify this protein and feed it to the mice in an experiment, but then it's very susceptible to stomach acidity, for example. So what if we just take the cells, we pasteurize them, so they're dead cells, but they're still intact, and the pili and all the outer membrane proteins and products are still there, then it can stimulate the immune system in the small intestine. And maybe, yeah, the host will just only respond to this molecule instead of needing the living microorganism. So that was the initial hypothesis. And when it proven to be true, I was super, super happy, of course. Also because making probiotics with anaerobic bacteria, it's just very difficult. And usually they don't smell very well. They make these components that are sort of these volatiles that don't smell very well. So a way around it to having to use anaerobic bacteria, yeah, was already in people's mind. And then, of course, when you can use pasteurized bacteria or even only the flagella or fragments, yeah, then a new thing word was thought for. People were talking about this postbiotic concept, which is very much broader than only dead cells.
I was just thinking about how exciting it must be to watch what's happened with that idea play out, because it's just been one success after another, it seems like.
Yes. Yes. And I'm a small player and I keep on doing my molecular research to prove more and more what can be the host molecular response towards these bacteria. But of course, there's many companies now that start to produce Akkermansia living cells, dead cells, and very importantly, of course, the European Food Safety Authority, the EFSA, approved pasteurized Akkermansia cells as a food additive. So it can be used safely, but only dead cells.
And I know you said, they're very difficult organisms to grow and they're difficult to maintain, to keep them alive, and especially in some kind of commercial form to feed to people. Are they genetically accessible? Are people able to manipulate them and really do the fundamental kind of work to dissect out what the important molecules are within Akkermansia?
So I think one of the difficulties was already to isolate new strains. So based on the 16S, Akkermansia isolates are all very similar. So I think there was very nice efforts being made worldwide where a lot of new Akkermansia strains and species are isolated and characterized. I didn't manage to make Akkermansia accessible, but there is a group in the US. They managed to make transposon mutagenesis. So it's not targeted mutagenesis, but at least they can make mutants and make selections. And from there, I think, this type of research should really be done, but it's not easy. I can see also from their research that, it's just very difficult. The reason is that Akkermansia muciniphilae belongs to a phylum called the Verrucomicrobium, and they're special in a way that they have special outer membrane structures, sometimes even double outer membranes. And I think this is why they behave very differently with the traditional techniques that we use to shoot things in or to electroporate them. It just doesn't work like that. And they're very sensitive to oxygen and stress. So all these stress factors to trying to get DNA in their cells, it also leads to a lot of non-surviving cells.
And do you think then that, we talked already about networks and cross-feeding and things like that, but, if you could create a microbiome that is missing Akkermansia and colonize a mouse or a human, if that was possible, do you think you'd lose a lot of other microbes that depend on Akkermansia to do these initial jobs of accessing the mucus?
That's a good question, because there's a lot of redundancy in the microbiome in function. And there's a really nice group of bacteria called Bacteroides, and they are generalists. So they can feed off a lot of different glycans, dietary glycans, but also mucosal glycans. So as soon as Akkermansia is not occupying the niche, another bacteria will step in, usually a Bacteroides, but can also be a Ruminococcus. It's also a group of bacteria that's very good in using mucus. So an Akkermansia is not there, and it's also what we see in our experiments in vitro in these synthetic communities, the niche are occupied. There's always bacteria that step in immediately and take up this niche that is otherwise taken by Akkermansia, and it forms a new microbial community. I think the biggest question is, that isn't solved yet, is does it matter if you have a completely different microbiome, but it does exactly the same thing for you, right?
Yeah, that's the really difficult thing. It's what we would say in math is a many-to-one function. There's many different ways to get the same result. I'm wondering, given, you know, this is an unfair question to ask a scientist, but do you think, Clara, that we've characterized all the possible functions that the microbiome have in terms of interacting with the host for health? And now it's just a matter of figuring out what compositions can give rise to optimal values of those functions? Or do you think that there's a whole lot of functions that we haven't even discovered yet?
Yes, I definitely think the second, because, well, for one is this Akkermansia, this pili, right? It's a protein that none of the other bacteria has this type of protein. That was why it was also so hard to characterize it, because there were no homologs. There are so many bacteria that we don't culture. They can shift their outer membrane composition, like the type, yeah, making different proteins and different situations. So it's also hard to predict when it's making what and how the host will respond towards it. And then, of course, we are focusing on bacteria, but there's also viruses, there's archaea there, and there's funguses there. So it's altogether, I think, no, there are so many more signals that we respond to. And there might be super interesting ones that we can use, like the 1100 protein, to stimulate certain things in our bodies for our own benefit. And I think there are also the synthetic communities where we can add glycans to stimulate more GABA production of bacteria, for example, or stimulate more 1100 production, so that we know that in the gut, if you would feed somebody a certain food type of glycan, that you know what your gut bacteria could do for you and produce more for you that you can respond towards. But I think there's many, many things still to discover.
I think that's a very optimistic note for scientists, at least, to finish on, Clara. So thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it, and we wish you every success with your ongoing research.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Clara.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions, or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. And check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.